Hey everybody, we're back. Episode 4 of BTAC Beyond the Bulletin. I'm Pete, your co-host, along with my friend and co-host.
Hi everyone, I'm Dr. Kristen Schneider. Wonderful to be here with you today.
So we've got a really good guest today and a really interesting topic.
This guy is
kind of a rock star in the threat management and threat assessment world. He's a supervisory deputy U.S. Marshal. He's a real legitimate U.S. Marshal.
He is indeed.
Not only that, he
is also the sergeant at arms.
Yeah, the
Association of Threat Assessment Professionals.
I was getting to that. Like, do we call him Sergeant Eric? Or can we just call him Eric? We'll have to ask him.
I think probably Sergeant at Arms at least once, and then maybe just Eric.
Just once. We'll get it out of the way, and it's just once. But because that's a long title, and then he's a DHS certified master trainer of behavioral threat assessment. He is a true SME, subject matter expert, because the acronyms here at the DOW are all over the place. Oh, and by the way, real quick. We've got our boss, Brandy, is joining us. Brandy, how are you?
I'm doing okay. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for being here with us. I didn't want to make sure we didn't forget you. But, Eric, welcome to BTAC Beyond the Bulletin.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
So I want to start off real quick by asking you a question. You're from New York, and I've asked you to bring your full New York personality with you. New York Mets or New York Yankees, and the correct answer is neither.
Oh, wow. We can still be friends, though, after the podcast. But I'm a Mets fan, an Islanders fan, and a Jets fan. And the good thing about being fans of all three of those is I'm never disappointed because I never have any hope.
Kristen, I got it right. We had a bet.
Pete wanted to know about baseball. I was much more excited to talk to you about football, and we were debating whether you'd be a Giants fan or a Jets fan.
Called it.
Although neither one of them are really too great this year. But, the Jets.
Speaking of football threat management, I mean, how do you deal with heartbreak and loss?
Lots of grievances in the football and baseball, and being an Islanders fan, same thing there. So not a lot of hope.
Well, so let's get into this. What's kind of neat about this episode, in my opinion, the first three episodes we've done. By the way, Eric, we've had some really phenomenal guests. No pressure. They've all been on topics, bulletin topics that we've already written, and they've been published. They're out there for public consumption, and then we've done a conversation about them with various different SMEs. Our podcast here, we're actually literally writing the bulletin as we speak, and the topic is threat mitigation and threat management. So we want to kind of get into that. As a U.S. Marshal, your job is to manage the threats to the judiciary, right? And as I look
at things,
you know, the people doing threat management out there in the real world, the FBI's BAU, the Secret Service, and frankly, the U.S. Marshals have probably the most amount of real live cases on their plates, and the highest degree of risk. Especially from a high profile perspective. I mean, how do you manage that in your role in your organization?
Well, it really comes down to investing in our people, training, mentoring, and also relying on our partners like the Bureau, DHS, and others out there to provide us with training and such. And I think it's just concentrating on making sure our people are taken care of because of the stressful kind of work that we do.
It's a great point. I mean, it is, talk about a team sport. threat management. It's, you know, often starts with one agency, but there's so much cross collaboration that has to happen for many of these situations to end up with successful outcomes. Tell us a little bit more about how you got to the Marshal Service. What was your pathway there?
So I started with the federal government in 2002, and I got here and they were starting to prepare for the 9/11 trials, and they told me I was going to go do a rotation in the Protective Intelligence Unit, and I really had no idea what that was, and then went over, did a few rotations, fell in love with the kind of work, and then been here for going on 16 years on this team. And so, yeah, it wasn't where I joined the Marshal Service to be like Tommy Lee Jones and The Fugitive and chase down the one-armed guy. And it just didn't work out that way. And I'm very grateful for the career path that we have, that I've had because of some great leaders that I've worked for throughout the years.
Was there a person in particular that influenced you to want to go to the Marshals? Or, I mean, obviously the movie was out after you started, right? Or was it before?
Oh, yeah. No, it was way before.
Yeah.
Way before. It was a number of factors of people in my life that put me on this path. But yeah, it's definitely something that I'm extremely grateful, because in essence, it's like winning the lottery. There's not many of us nationwide, and especially getting into this small subset of specialty in the Marshal Service is even smaller. So extremely grateful and fortunate.
So talk about the responsibilities that you have. You have obviously the federal judiciary, and that
correct.
also kind of includes the Supreme Court, or no?
We share it with okay. The Supreme Court police.
And I would assume that many of your people of concern are in the criminal justice system, the federal criminal justice system. I'm thinking that maybe they've had a case in front of this judge, and they've got some anger about how they were. Talk to us like about the people of concern and how they come across your radar.
It's a mix with people with a personal grievance, and there is a mix of those who may have seen something in the news or following something that they feel the need to sound off.
Interesting. So I think that, you know, threat assessment is a whole different category. We want to really focus on mitigation versus management. And a lot of our research in writing this bulletin is folks oftentimes use the term mitigation and management interchangeably. And I think, right, Kristen? And like, you know.
Yeah. And often have the sense that they're not the same thing, but find it difficult to articulate what exactly the distinction might be.
Yeah. How do you look at it?
So if I could use a Star Wars reference, like threat management would be like the Death Star, and then mitigation would be one of the Star Destroyers with a specific role out there. So like you said, it is definitely separate, but mitigation would fall under management and stuff. And without, you know, you can do a great assessment and come up with a level of concern for your person of concern, but without being crafty in your mitigation, you really have a flawed management plan and a management team.
Well, that's a great point. I mean, really, to be at all useful, good threat assessment really needs to get you to a point where you're prepared for management, not just sort of identifying risk, right? But maybe getting you ready to do something with it.
Absolutely.
We were thinking, I think our big picture thought process was the mitigation reduces that urgency of imminence, right? So what can we do immediately to take that risk level down short term? It's high risk in that moment, but then the management is the long term strategy. Is that how you approach that?
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. And also, you know, it also really relies heavily on how you triage your information of concern or persons of concern is really the key here. Is to your point, is, you know, do we really need to do things right away, or is it something that we could take a little bit more time and assess and find out more information? So I think imminence is something of great concern when initially receiving something in the triage process.
You know, I think of the Secret Service, and I think of the volume of tips they receive or indicators that they receive, regardless of the president. You know, each president brings their own, we'll call them fan clubs, with them, right? So they can't investigate every single individual who says something that's, of a threatening nature to a president, right? You've got to assess the viability and the practicality of what the person's saying. In this profession, we look at howlers versus hunters, who's just out there like howling.
Yeah.
Right.
People making threats versus people actually posing a threat. There can be overlap there, but not everyone who makes a threat actually does pose a threat. And not everyone who poses a threat makes a threat, right? So being able to pay attention to that distinction. I imagine in the work that you do, that's a big, big part of your initial effort, is trying to understand that distinction.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the main factors we're looking at, is there any fixation behavior? Like, is there just solely focused on one issue at hand? Or do they seem to follow a wide range of issues or things related to them personally, or that might be covered in the news?
That's a great point. But so you'd be more concerned about the person who's just angry about that one thing, just focused on that one thing, as opposed to somebody who is upset about or angry about a lot of different things.
Right. And also, is it personal or is it ideological or potentially political? And then you have to, weigh the entire, totality of the circumstances to see what you have.
I just thought of something I was curious about, especially your thoughts. When you have, because you're dealing with the justice system, a lot of people are incarcerated. Do you have individuals that are making threats that are incarcerated? So therefore, there's a mitigation. Their risk level has been mitigated to a degree if they're incarcerated. How much does incarceration factor into your risk management perspective?
Well, is it long term? Is it short term? And then what contacts do they have on the outside? Are they part of a larger organization, a criminal network or something of the such? And, or obviously, is there some isolation there and they have a very lengthy jail sentence in front of them?
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Thank you. So I remember you presented what we call a CWT, a community-wide training, a couple months ago, I think. And that's the first time I ever heard, I think I knew your name, but I first time I actually heard you speak, and you had a great vignette about a person of concern that you would have, your group would take out to breakfast, right, as part of the management strategy. Can you kind of elaborate a little bit more on that?
We try and operate under a hugs before handcuffs mantra, where a large population of all persons of concern have something going on. And, more often than not, we don't have the criminal justice system as a avenue of mitigation. And so therefore, we need to be crafty in our approach. I argue that people write, people post, people call is because they don't feel like they are being heard. And also people that, often feel that way often lack hope, which is one of the strongest risk reducers, mitigators I see. And that's something that we really, really weigh heavily on. Does this person have plans for the future, educational goals, career goals, family goals, hobbies, interests, all of those things? And that's, if someone has a lot of those things going on, then we can maybe lower our concerns a little bit. Then, in contrast, someone with no hope, no other interests, no goals, nothing, really positive going on, then our concerns become elevated. But, we really try and address the person as a person so to speak. And I believe that empathy is one of the most powerful tools that we have as threat assessors. And that's really being the ear to some people that might not feel like they're being heard. You know, we will address a person's, you know, like, hey, tell me about your sleep. Tell me about you, you know, eat. Do you need public assistance getting food? Are there other type of public assistance that you might be eligible for that we could help you with? You know, would you like to speak to someone to maybe help you sort through your thoughts? Is there a family member or something that we could speak to on your behalf or someone else to see if there's something that we could do for you? So, yeah, it's very non-traditional in the law enforcement sense to have a conversation to be like, hey, well, tell me about your sleep pattern. Tell me about, you know, how are you eating? What do you do to manage stress? You know, like my first, you know, couple line of questions is, all right, well, you know, tell me about you. What do you do for fun? You know, have a conversation, you know, like what do you do in your spare time?
And starting connecting with people.
Yeah, because it's really about people. You've got to be a people person. And, you know, my vetting process to get someone on my team is, you know, a general interest in threat assessment, maybe some background knowledge is helpful. And I do that when we take forensic psychology externs that I mentor from John Jay. It's the same thing. I can teach you all of these things, but I can't teach you not to be a jerk.
Yeah. Right. And, you got to start with some good raw material.
Right. Care, empathy, and those types of things. And one of the first conversations we have is, all right, well, tell me the difference between empathy and sympathy. And why is empathy the better route to go when dealing with our persons of concern?
Wow. I like that. It really asks people to engage in a different way and kind of step out of an academic mindset that they might be used to. If you're talking about the internship or externship, as it might be, to really ask them to do, again, something that's not always so easy for people, but to step outside of themselves and to make that connection first.
Speaking as a former cop, like, I wouldn't say I had a lot of empathy back when I was on the street, but I also didn't have a lot of time. You know, you're answering calls for service, you're on patrol, a lot of other things you have to be doing. So teaching law enforcement in particular to be a little more empathetic and ask these questions that are unique. You know, it's not just the facts, ma'am. It's how do you feel? Like it's not intuitive necessarily to at least the policing that I grew up under.
Yeah. It's, you know, to use like an analogy a little bit, it's like you go to this doctor who's a phenomenal doctor but has a terrible bedside manner. Mm-hmm. You often end up having that conversation about that doctor with your family, friends, or peers, or whatever it is, and you talk about how terrible that doctor was at the bedside, and you're really missing the whole point of the FaceTime that you had with that doctor and stuff. So I think really zoning in on the people aspect and encourage my people to use people's names in their conversation.
Yeah.
You know, ask them, what would you like me to refer to you as? What could, you know, please call me Eric, and have that conversation. Every time you use someone's name, you're putting a deposit in the emotional bank account and really showing them that they are a person as opposed to your subject. And that's also, too, is like you hear when I'm referring to, it's trying removing a lot of the law enforcement jargon is, this isn't my subject. This is our person of concern. Again, that's another challenge for law enforcement. But really, is
terminology.
Especially how you say and what you say matters. And especially if you're going to go to an emergency room and deal with a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a social worker, and you really keep trying to express your concerns about someone, you keep calling this subject or Smith or this or that. It's like sort of like a Jedi mind trick, for another Star Wars reference, is to like, hey, this person is concerning and they are a person to me.
Yeah. I feel like Eric's a bigger fan of Star Wars than he is of the Jets, but I digress.
I am quite the Star Wars nerd, I have to admit. I do have a decent amount of Star Wars paraphernalia in my office.
Our director James Chappelle will approve.
Yeah.
Strongly,
okay.
I think.
Yeah, he's a
James
big fan.
Is also
good.
A big Star Wars fan.
But he's a Yankees fan.
I hope the force is with him.
It's you know, talking about management and mitigation, the other thing that kind of comes up for me is thinking about just how much of a long-term strategy these things often are. And Pete, you sparked this when you mentioned that, you know, a lot of sort of traditional law enforcement is just thinking about the single interaction that you're having with that person in the moment, not necessarily building a relationship with them. But I think that And Eric, I think I've heard you talk about this before, that a lot of your threat management work is really about building relationships.
It is. I mean, it's, again, referring back to, it's all about people. It's showing some good faith on behalf of the government. It's showing that there is hope. It's showing that there's good people out there, and showing people that what they have to say matters.
I think that's exactly right. I'm consistently impressed with people that I meet across different agencies who do threat assessment and management. And I think hopefully our listeners are starting to get a flavor of this across our podcast, maybe have been perhaps a little surprised by how often things like emotional intelligence or empathy, compassion, how much these concepts are coming up in our discussions. But I think it's revealing, because I think this is true across this enterprise of this work that we all do together. And so hopefully people are going to get a different look into this world. Eric, what are some of the things that you've been most surprised by as you've really entered this world of threat assessment, threat management, and threat mitigation? You've also come from a law enforcement background.
Yeah, I will say the evolving, I guess, threat picture, so to speak, the changes is from when I started, it was people sending mail and faxes, and then to the changes in technology, which could be a challenge. You know, we've seen over the last couple of years with more people with a lot going on, which seem to be suffering for one reason or another. And so I think that's been a challenge. And I also think is, you know, the mental health system is taxed.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a challenge for us for sure, that we really need to put some resources there to making sure that the people that are crying out are getting the help that they need.
You don't sound like, you're not talking like a cop. It's amazing. Like, you're talking, it's just, and I mean it in a very positive way. I mean, my law enforcement roots are strong, but like, you're just, it's such a different way of thinking and acting. It's like, it's caring. It's really.
Well, the big thing is too, is a lot of times, you know, our biggest persons of concern have not committed any crimes.
Right.
And so therefore you don't have that. And don't take anything I say here that I'm condemning, condoning, or do not believe that the criminal justice system should be utilized. I just think it should be utilized to punish poor behavior in certain circumstances when it's the best avenue for mitigation. And I think you have to weigh the pros and cons of each of those in every step, because, you know, as you'll see with a lot of people that are maybe incarcerated, their length of potential incarceration is not very long, and then they come out worse off than when they went in. You know, that being said, you know, there are people where arrest is the absolute best avenue that people should take. It's a case-by-case basis. We should not be violation-driven. We should be mitigation-driven.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, we get to somebody before they've taken an action that would lead to incarceration, right? Ideally, we notice those red flags earlier and can intervene before that whenever possible. I think that's really the goal, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think incarceration, when appropriate, is a great mitigation. It's not really a strategy. It's just a mitigation series of events. It doesn't address underlying, though, fundamentals that would lead towards a management perspective. I mean, I think back to my time, you know, just in talking about, you know, cops and being in law enforcement, going to the scene of a domestic violence call, a domestic in progress, right? And your husband and wife are arguing, hasn't become physical, no one's getting locked up, but clearly these two people shouldn't spend the night together in the same house. So let's mitigate this by saying, hey, sir, I can't kick you out of your house, but it'd be really great if you cooled off somewhere and went to a hotel, went to your family, stayed somewhere else tonight. And it won't, so that mitigates the risk of, you know, something bad happening that night, but it doesn't address the long term, you know, whether he just lost his job. What are the underlying stressors that kind of caused the argument to get to the point where the neighbors all of a sudden had to call 911? Just to use an analogy, if you will,
yeah,
of mitigation versus management.
Yeah. You just say every case is different. You have to, you know, see all of the things that are behind it, you know, and, you know, that being said, sometimes some bad behavior needs to have some consequences. So right. We're weighing all our avenues, dealing with our other stakeholders and prosecutors to see which is our best avenue that we have here, because there are some benefits that can come from a prosecution, like mandated mental health and other types of things that you could put in place. But like I said, everything is specific. There is no cookie cutter approach. There is no checklist. It's always with everything, the totality of the circumstances you have in front of you. And also realizing that those circumstances may and probably will change. And so looking yes. down the road at precipitating events that could occur and preparing for those and say, oh, you know, all right, so well, let's push this forward, and 2 months from now when we have this happen, you know, are we going to have any second thoughts about how we handled it here? So I think that type of foreshadowing, so to speak, is very important as well.
Well, you opened the door to I gotta get this question in, Ian, Kristen, because Ian said, Pete, you gotta ask this question. So you talked about stakeholders. How do you build relationships with stakeholders, other folks, other risk owners? You know, the Marshal Service is small but mighty, right? But you've got to rely on relationships. Who do you try to build relationships with, and how important are they towards your threat management strategies?
Anyone from the gentleman or the lady cleaning the bathroom all the way to some of our protected persons, is because we all have a role in reporting behavior of concern. And then also providing training on things to look for, the warning signs, but then also how to report them. But I think the biggest thing is earning their confidence that we are competent and experts in threat management, I think is the key to making sure that they know when someone reports something is that we're going to handle it with kid gloves. We are going to be aggressive in our assessment, and we really truly have everyone's well-being, from our persons to our persons of concern to everybody's best interest at heart.
Relationship building is in my opinion, it's a verb. You should constantly be trying to build relationships with other stakeholders, with other risk owners, with other agencies. You know, you're very involved in ATAP, the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals. Both Kristen and I are members. You know, how important has that relationship been to you, both in your own your further professionalization, but in terms of building resources for cases? How's that relationship worked out? I mean, you're a sergeant of arms, for goodness sakes.
So I can speak as a member on my experience.
Yeah.
And that I can't give it an official statement from an ATAP
no.
board of directors point of view. But I will say that it has been nothing short but phenomenal for my career progression, for my education, my networking, on having these contacts available to go into a Rolodex and say, I need someone from XYZ organization in threat management, and I need to speak to them either right away or it's not urgent. And that has been really the key, because, you know, having someone that speaks the threat management language and understands the things that we are trying to accomplish as far as mitigation, and we very well may not be building a criminal case at this time, or maybe we will be, but to have that conversation, to discuss, hey, you know what, I've seen some pathway to violence behavior here. There's yep. a lot of risk enhancers that we've identified, you know, and to someone that speaks that same language and to basically show the urgency of what we have, or just the, maybe we need to make a notification, because as we've seen in past attacks, the silos, yeah, which have been identified, were a huge, huge factor in certain cases. So having those outlets to remove those silos, I think, has been key.
Yeah, having those relationships before you need them, right? So that, yeah, you know you've got a case that comes up, and I'm sure you're dealing with things all over the country, right? So needing to connect with people from different agencies. I think you're right. ATAP has been, I think, for a lot of people, that place to make those connections outside of your own agency, which I think is just one of the things, not the only thing, but one of the really incredible things about participating in that organization. I have to say, I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, it's been phenomenal. I mean, the just personal friends that I've met and I now keep in touch with and say hello on holidays and other stuff, it's just, or they look me up when they're in town to come say hello. I just can't say enough good things about it.
Yeah, ATAP for me is it's the perfect blend of the academics and the practitioners, right? Because, yeah, you've got this such a, you know, some of the giants in the academic world that have written and published on the topics of threat assessment and threat management. And then you combine with the practitioners, you know, folks like you, folks like Kerry Gibson from BAU, you know, all over the place, different, and then cops on the streets. There's detectives and other threat managers that can come together at least twice a year, but in even regionally there's meetings and training that goes on. That stuff is so important from a professional and development.
Some of the most incredible continuing education opportunities between the winter conference, yeah, the annual threat management conference, and then all of the really tremendous work that all of the chapters do. There's not a month that goes by that there's not some kind of incredible presentation that they're doing. So for folks that haven't gotten involved with ATAP, check them out. I couldn't recommend this organization highly enough.
You do need a sponsor, right? Yep. Right. I think someone who's a member has to sponsor you in, but it's open to practitioners, academics, I think students, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm making that up, but I think it's atap.org. Yeah, that's definitely a good resource for a lot of our audience. By the way, our audience can find our podcast now, and I gotta give a hat tip to Kristen. You know, Chris is the man here. Chris,
oh yeah,
our sound engineer extraordinaire.
Sound engineer extraordinaire. Yep.
He got us to this point. He edits all of our stuff to make us sound great,
professional,
decent, like, you know, professionally decent, right? And then he's got us on the internet, and, you know, we're on Apple Podcasts now, we're on Spotify, we're wherever you YouTube. We actually can say legitimately
wherever you get your podcast.
Exactly.
So, I love that.
So thank you, Chris. Chris is shaking his head, going, okay. New title: Sound Engineer Extraordinaire. I just made it up, by the way.
I like it.
I think it's great. Eric, you know, one of the analogies that some of the thought leaders in threat management have created is not Star Wars, but cardiologist. And you know, a cardiologist will look at the symptoms of an individual who might have heart disease. They will look at the research, but there's not an ability to predict who is going to have a heart failure or heart attack at some point in time. But they're combining a lot of these different areas of experience and personal knowledge and the whole person. You know, is that a philosophy that you adopt and your folks adopt in terms of threat management?
Absolutely, because, you know, there are so many unknowns. You know, you brought up the point of hunters and howlers, and also a true, you know, hunter, you could compare to a widowmaker.
Yeah.
You know, the heart attack that really comes out of nowhere, which the people is very hard to detect and whatnot. And so therefore, you know, like, there's not a lot to be known. A true practitioner who's trying to fly under the radar, using tradecraft to disguise, to make sure their plans are not known, you know, it's definitely going to be difficult to identify. Yeah, I think that's a great analogy.
It is, and we've got to properly cite it because it's a creation of Andre Simmons from who's retired from the FBI and BAU.
I know Andre well,
and great guy. And then Dr. Reed Malloy, who you know, one of the big thinkers in the threat management. They wrote it's on the tip of my tongue here because I make my students read it. Fundamentals of Threat Management. It's a publication that they wrote several years ago. So it's not like Kristen and I came up with the cardiologist analogy. We can't take credit for that, unfortunately. But we'll take it. We'll use it and cite it appropriately. So again, back to this concept of threat mitigation and threat management. Distinct differences, right? But there's a flow. There's a flow. It's almost like we mitigate before we manage. How do you like this sentence? In essence, management is the choreography of mitigation.
I like it.
It doesn't seem like it's bumper sticker worthy to you.
I like it. I think it definitely is. Like I said, I think of threat management as the broad, and I think of mitigation as a piece of that. You know, you could also throw into threat management protective responses, you know, what type of target hardening you're going to do. You know, I think of that as the overall program. I think with mitigation, you need to be crafty in your approach. Also, going back to the cardiologist, you know, you have all those risk factors going on in your life. Like, how, as us as threat mitigators, can we make you better as a person? You know, like do comparison to the heart disease. All right, we're going to stop you from smoking. Yeah. We're going to give you some exercise. We're going to find you some hobbies. You know, we're going to change your diet a little bit. Well, same thing goes with our persons of concern. You know, what type of help can we give them as a whole, which could lower their risk to carrying out an act of targeted violence?
I like
That takes both time and resources, right? I mean, I can imagine, and I think this will resonate with you, even within our department, resources are always a challenge, right? And we're talking about big organizations. I imagine a lot of our listeners are working for much smaller organizations or in locations where there's just less access to resources. I wonder if that brings us back to what we were talking about before of sort of making connections cross agencies and things like that. Is that a challenge that you run up against?
I think that's everywhere, which we have. You know, it's different for each organization or each person, you know, what it is. You know, I've specifically in New York, it's, you know, there's mental health crisis going on. And so, you know, that seems to be one of our biggest challenges is getting some of the people that the support they need when they're, you know, going through a hard time. But again, getting those connections, building the ark before the flood, as they say, don't wait until you need it to then have to go introduce yourself to the local county threat assessment team or the psych ward or whatever it might be. Like, build that relationship first. Go down there, introduce yourself, say, hey, you know, this is what we do here. You know, we work behavioral threat assessment and management, and you know, we make assessments and try and identify people that are of concern and of higher risk for targeted violence and such. And it just goes a long way to have those introductions and those people in your Rolodex beforehand.
Well, and it's a long-term process too. Like, you have a person of concern, you've got a management strategy, and it requires energy and dedication to keep that person on the radar. Right. And that patience, that long term kind of keeping your eye on the ball for such a long time, that's not easy.
No.
Oh, no, wait, just knowing when to close a case, that can be really challenging.
Well, Eric's actually written on this, right? Right? Eric, this is where I got the idea for Eric, because he posted something on LinkedIn about this whole topic of when's it okay to close a case. What do you think, Eric?
You know, just a wide variety of factors goes into that. You know, it's not just one. Again, I can't say it. And when I teach ad nauseum, am I discussing the totality of the circumstances? It is very, very, very rarely is it just one factor that's going to, you know, make you break out some ninjas or whatever it might be response to your case. But, you know, for the most part, it's going to be always all the factors that you have in there. And so, you know, is this behavior within your person of concern's baseline behavior? You know, like, have they been acting like this and acting out for 20 years and without any escalations or without any deviations in their behavior? You know, obviously people see, oh, we were looking for escalations, but we also sometimes need to see a de-escalation in behavior. It's like, have they gone from, you know, howler to hunter is something to take into effect. You know, do the risk mitigators that have been identified greatly outweigh the risk enhancers? What, you know, protective factors, what types of things here, and articulating all those? Because I think one thing that I see is a wide range and deficit in writing and documenting, and people being fearful of writing certain things because of legal. And just like, you know, everyone knows here, if it's not in your report, it didn't happen. And so by documenting all of these things in a, I guess, a well thought out planned way that you could go through everything and see, and, you know, like quoting making prevention a reality, right, as, hey, this is where we've come up with our level of concern based on other things, which I think is a great way of also showing that, you know, we're looking through this through many different lenses from our team, but we're also referencing, you know, the great periodical studies and guides that are out there that are also saying, hey, our assessment of our person of concern is on point or on par with this publication or Hunters and Howlers and, you know, all of the other great ones out there that you might want to cite.
So yeah, building on what has come before.
Yeah.
But also using that creative approach to mitigation. I mean, you've mentioned more than once that it's, you kind of have to tailor your mitigation to each individual case because you're going to manage them very differently depending on that constellation of stressors and strengths, protective factors that
crafty,
the individual has.
Crafty, right? That word crafty. Yep. I like that. I like that word crafty, actually. Because it's creative, but also I kind of like that.
Yeah, and it's not a checklist.
Right.
You know, it could be just being an ear to someone. It could be, you know, helping someone with some bureaucracy, getting some, you know, paperwork, or we've helped people get their VA benefits. You know, I mean, it's just a wide range of things. And also, don't be afraid to address an issue that a person is having, even if it's not related to the grievance, that the reason why it's come to your attention. So, you know, it could
Great
be totally
point.
Totally unrelated to the issue at hand, but the better, you know, place you put that person in, you can reduce the likelihood of targeted violence.
Yeah, if it's still a stressor in their life that's impacting them, then addressing that, you're right, helps to reduce their overall risk.
Yeah, and back to the documentation. How do you write up, took my person of concern to coffee. We had a nice conversation. He seems like he's in a good mood. Like, you know, it's difficult, but those are all, that's an important event that happened that could have a lot of cascading positive impacts down the road. But how do you document that we had a great conversation? He seems like he's upbeat.
Well, you know, you discuss, well, you know, our person of concern today was dressed appropriately for the weather. They made frequent eye contact. There are no common signs attributable to, you know, lack of taking care of themselves or however you want to word it. And it's being descriptive in that. And obviously we want to be careful unless you have a, you know, you're a psychiatrist or a psychologist or not to diagnose. We want to just describe what we're seeing. And this way, when I do bring it to a psychologist or someone else that might read this report, that they can get a picture of what we're looking at and also come to the draw the conclusion that we are based on what we're seeing and putting it in the report.
Well, that's a credit to you because the professionalism that you've developed over all these years in conjunction and with the help of groups like ATAP, you get an idea of what a psychologist is looking for, the questions that they will ask, and you're answering them up front in your interactions, your write-ups of your interactions. That's phenomenal. And I think a good takeaway for folks that are working threat management.
And our behavioral science SME group is actually working on an upcoming bulletin on objective reporting for behavioral threat assessment. How do you do this if this is not something that comes naturally? Some examples of things that are helpful and things that are not so helpful in terms of reporting. And I think people might find it useful.
Do we have a guest lined up?
Not yet. We've got to work on that.
But I can give some a little bit thoughts on that. Like I said, be descriptive.
Yeah.
State what you see. Don't diagnose. Be thorough. Like I said, if it didn't end up in your report, it didn't happen. Some people are stronger writers than others. Don't be afraid to use bullet points and to describe a behavior, as opposed to, you know, going into this, you know, 4 score and 7 years ago dissertation. Sometimes, you know, bullet points might be the best way to go. And also sometimes a little bit cleaner and easier to read than going into like a more of a formal format type report.
Very true.
It's a great, great point. The retirement of a case, you know, we've kind of alluded to it. You wrote about it on LinkedIn. I thought it was a phenomenal piece of thought leadership there on your part. I worry at some point in time, you know, we have to close cases that are appropriate to close. But there's got to be a lingering, but what if we're no longer monitoring this person? We've retired the case. You know, how do you let go of that particular case that you've been so focused on for such a period of time, but you've got confidence and I love how you talked about how you're citing making prevention a reality in terms of why you're closing this case, but is there a underlying like, yeah, but what if something bad happened to him and he reignites and becomes a threat? I mean, where are you at with that in terms of once it's retired, it's retired?
So, you know, you try and put, you know, mitigation strategies like third-party monitoring or other types of things where maybe you could also have the name flag with the police department that, hey, if there's, you know, a mental health crisis there, if you could please let us know. And also educating your stakeholders to report subsequent, you know, communication of concern or whatever it is. But I think that really, you know, obviously, you know, we can't keep an assessment over for infinity, but hopefully be able to put some of those safeguards in place, which I think is one of the best ones, is third-party monitoring through family, friends, or other means that, hey, if things seem to change here, here are some resources for you, and here's my number if you need to report anything, and we're here for you if anything or you have any questions. And building that rapport and those relationships with people's family members and friends and that rapport and stuff, I think, is really key.
Yeah. So that you can always reopen if you need to.
Yeah. It's all about the baseline behavior to seeing where they are. Some people are not nice. Some people are evil. Some people are weird. Some people don't fit into our social norms, but that might be their normal everyday, how they operate. And so then we feel a little better that, okay, this person's been this exact way for a very long time. And then we feel a lot better. And then having some extra eyes for us is also extremely helpful.
Yeah, back to Ian's point, and he's going to love us for this, you know, the relationships and having I know the FBI calls them tripwires. I kind of hate that.
Yeah.
It seems rather like, I don't know, consultant like word, but like, you know, the relationships that you've built, having eyes and ears out there to be able to remember the name if there's an arrest, if there's something that pops, and having those relationships built in already, I think are huge in this, because it's a tough space to be in. I mean, like you alluded to, folks haven't necessarily committed a crime, and therefore the law enforcement process, whether it's state or local or federal, isn't necessarily the best path. So how do we deal in the gray? It's threat management, and I think you all do it incredibly, incredibly well. Hats off to you and the Marshall Service on how you deal with this, like this issue.
Thank you.
So last question. You know, we like to ask our guests a lot of the things that we do. We see a lot of bad stuff, right? Or we're dealing with people that have a lot of challenges. It can weigh on your psyche. How do you, Eric, work to counter that? What are your hobbies? How do you step away from work and kind of reset? Besides watching Jets,
Star Wars
and not watching a Jets game, how do you decompress?
Well, for me personally, I focus on sleep, exercise, and nutrition. And so thankfully, we have a phenomenal gym across the street in the other office. But I luckily enough have a rather large size office. And so I have a little area with some sandbags. And so I can just shut my door and get a quick workout in and such, as opposed to having to, change, walk across the street, get engaged in conversation. There's no excuses on why I can't even get in 10 minutes to making sure that here is. And also really just focusing on general life to making sure that I'm, leaving the stress of the job, at the office.
Yeah.
Before I got promoted to, manage the team, I just had to worry about my finite set of cases. And now I have everyone on the team's cases on my radar. So the stress certainly increased a little bit since, getting promoted a few years ago. As far as a team managing the stress, so, we, on a voluntary basis, we take the stairs. I can't force my people to take the stairs, but we're on the fourth floor.
I love that.
And so, voluntarily, you take the stairs instead of the elevator to get your steps in. Also, I got a pull-up bar for one of the doorways. And so once or twice a day, encouraging people to get up from their desk, do some air squats, do some push-ups, do some pull-ups. Every time you pass the pull-up bar, you should pay the man, so to speak,
yep.
and do a set. And I'm pretty famous for grabbing everyone from their desk. Like, all right, we're going to go do a walk and talk and get some fresh air, get some sun, some vitamin D, and stuff. And then also, lastly, is the separation, having people call after hours and be like, okay, I'm all games. I'll sign on the laptop. Let's have this conversation. Is this emergent right now? Or do you want to talk first thing in the morning? And having that separation. All right, if this isn't urgent right now, I appreciate the call, but go spend some time with family.
Yeah.
And we'll circle back in the morning. And being able to make those separations, because I've got some real hard charges on my team that sometimes we've got to be like, hey, you know what? I'm all in. If you need to have this conversation right now, let's do it. But if not, I want you to go get some rest, go get some family time, whatever it might be, and to making sure that you are taking care of yourself. Because I hate to use the analogy, but it's like being on the airplane. You're supposed to put on your oxygen mask to take care of yourself first before you can help others. And I believe, there's been a ton of people in the space, like Dr. Braden has done phenomenal talks related to this exact thing on wellness and self-care and such, which I just think is so, can't be understated, because the amount of stressful work that we do here, because really lives are in the balance.
Yeah, and talking about Dr. Braden, like if you've seen her present in public, she'll make you do group breathing exercises. It's kind of weird at first.
I love it.
I love it. It's cool. And I'm guessing that Eric has a yoga mat in his office. I if not now, he will. It's stretching and yoga. I'm just offering it as a suggestion.
I do a fair amount of stretching. I'm getting a little older in my age, so I'm not as flexible as I used to be. So there is. I do have a mat. I have a little, 4x6 padded area in the corner of my office to to get in some workout. I have a kettle, but two kettlebells and a couple sandbags and some bands for some stretching to help me get it. But yeah, I mean, I can't stress enough how important it is to making sure that you are taking care of yourself, because what could follow is not good for anyone. And we need people like us. It is.
And getting, you know, focusing on the body, getting into the body is a good way of getting out of your head after a long, tough day.
Oh, totally, yeah. All right, so my last question is this, and this is something I just thought of. Who has a parade in New York first? The New York Mets or the New York Jets?
Oh, I think it has to be the Mets.
You think so? Yeah, I mean, they're a better team. They're a better team.
I mean, the Jets just won their third game of the season, I think, yesterday.
It's a long way. It's a long way from a parade, yeah.
Yeah, it's a long way. I got to think. If I had a guess, I would say maybe if we're doing it, I would maybe – Mets and Islanders are probably in the same boat, both in the rebuilding phase. You know, I'm just so crushed by every September the Mets just crumble like a cheap suit. And so hopefully that will change, but I'll still root for them. And like I mentioned early on, it's like at least I'm never disappointed when things go bad.
Philadelphia sports, the answer is neither.
So great. Eric, thank you so much for being here with us today to talk about this stuff. I know we had some initial technical challenges, but you have been just a fantastic guest. Thanks for persevering with us.
I enjoyed it. I love it. I could talk nerd out on this every day, any day. So I really appreciate, honored for the invite, and hopefully share the information to make an influence, you know, an impact, and hopefully save some lives.
Thanks a lot, Eric. Appreciate you joining us, and look forward to meeting up with you to do some yoga soon.
Sounds good, guys. Thanks so much. Take care.
Take it easy, bud.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The views and opinions presented herein are those of the interviewer and or interviewee and do not necessarily represent the views of the Department of War or its components, including Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency, or DCSA. Further, any reference to the use of specific resources or consultation with non-government personnel does not constitute endorsement by the Department of War, its components, or DCSA.